Hi, this is Sean Backey from CLNS Radio and the Evening Score Sports Podcast. Kickstart your new year and challenge yourself to learn something new with a free 10-day trial to lynda.com. lynda.com is used by millions of people around the world and has over 4,500 courses on topics like web development, photography, visual design, and business, as well as software training like Excel, WordPress, and Photoshop. All of their courses are taught by experts, and new courses are added to the site every week. Whether you want to set new financial goals, find work-life balance, invest in a new hobby, ask your boss for a raise, or even find a new job or improve upon the current job skills in 2015, lynda.com has something for everyone. Now, if you sign up today for the free 10-day trial by visiting lynda.com/CLNS, you'll get the benefits of unlimited access to every course on lynda.com. You'll also get access to view tutorials on tablets and iPhone and Android mobile devices, as well as access to new courses added every week. Some of the courses that were recommended for me include analyzing your website to improve SEO, viral marketing, and web analytics fundamentals. Do something good for yourself in 2015 and sign up for the free 10-day trial to lynda.com by visiting lynda.com/CLNS. Go ahead, I challenge you to learn something new in 2015.
Welcome to the Boston Celtics postgame show on CLNSradio.com.
Off the turnover, Rondo reverse, banks it in.
Fans, this is your destination for interactive Celtics coverage all season long.
Kelly still has time, takes it.
So what are you waiting for? We want to hear from you. Dial in at 347-215-7771.
Green out of the corner, got another one.
Now let's get it started.
Who's Rajon Rondo? I don't even know who that guy is. It's all about Evan Turner. Evan Turner, are you not how are you not excited? Now, whether it is a deflated ball that went through the hoop in Portland, because that's what everyone's talking about in the sports world. But we got to get on some of this. Yeah. Game if you're a Boston Celtics fan. How could you not be excited? How could you not be excited for this game? Unbelievable outcome. I know it was just another day in the association, but with where the Celtics went, oh my goodness. Welcome in to the post-game show on the Boston Celtics post-game report here on CLNS Radio, and I am here with my co-host. Here he is.
Instead, Mike Hugh. Yeah, your enthusiasm is already burying me. I'm basically on my deathbed tonight. But, exciting win tonight for your Boston Celtics. Evan Turner with the three off of what looked to be another botched play from Jared Sullinger, managed to get the ball out, and Evan Turner just hit the big clutch three.
You talk about a botched three. I mean, a botched play. I mean, talk about just... This is one thing I noticed from the Celtics tonight, and we'll get to the game in a second. There's one thing I noticed from the Celtics tonight that I'm sure is pretty much a common trend throughout the entire year from what it looked like in this game. There were multiple sequences of events where you could tell this team is still just too young. They're not there yet as a team, but they are. You can see. Portions and moments throughout the game where this team has the potential down the road to be a big-time contender. And watching them tonight, I got to admit, there were some impressive things I saw, and I am really stoked for this team. And I don't know, it's because they had a three-pointer at the end of the game, and that helped it. It's their first road win on the road against a Western Conference team since February 25th of 2013. How could that is baffling. That's some time. Like that is doing some time in the Western Conference on the road. And as we know, when it comes to the Eastern Conference, when it comes to the Eastern Conference, I mean, that's comparatively the West. I mean, this is just geographical stuff here. I don't want to bore you with it being a geographical statement, but I mean, the West is more of a, you know, it is the Wild West. There's a lot of open space out here. And in the East Coast, I mean, it takes maybe 25, 30 minutes, what it feels like, 25, 30 minutes to go from Boston to New York. Well, here, you know, Portland is literally the middle of nowhere. I mean, everything around Portland is nothing. Whereas Boston, you know, you got some teams south of them. I mean, if you want to make the comparison, it's the, but the point is that there's nothing out here in the on the West. So for the Boston Celtics to travel out west, it's brutal all by itself. And so for the way they performed tonight against a, let's be honest, the second best team in the West, definitely a top three team in the NBA right now at the halfway point, 31-12, and yes, they came into this game short of LaMarcus Aldridge, out 6 to 8 weeks now with a torn left thumb ligament, collateral ligament in his left thumb, which, I mean, come on. I'm sure the Boston attitude or any kind of real Boston attitude would say, hey, look, come on, put a cast on it, go out there and play. You're going to be in the All-Star game. You better be in the All-Star. I mean, he's probably not going to play because of his stupid hand, but, I mean, let's be honest. This guy is a bona fide superstar, and him being out really helped the Boston Celtics. There was definitely moments in this game where I noticed that LaMarcus Aldridge looked, I mean, not LaMarcus Aldridge, but LaMarcus Aldridge's presence being out really benefited the Celtics. I mean, yeah, they if you really watched this game, there wasn't a ton of action, but there was a lot of good things to recognize from. What did you see there out there? I'm going to get, what's your name again? My co-host? I'm my awful.
It's okay. My name is Calvin. Calvin Chamberlain,
Calvin.
Actually.
That's right. Yeah. I knew you were Chamberlain. I knew you weren't the. I knew you weren't Wilt Chamberlain. I knew you weren't
right.
Wilt Chamberlain, but I knew your last name had the effect. What did you? So you watched the game tonight. What were some of the things you saw from the Boston Celtics outside of the obvious fourth quarter amazing comeback?
Well, I thought the defense played surprisingly well in this game. You know, like you said, LaMarcus Aldridge is out to 6 to 8 weeks, and I think at a certain point, Portland will be able to adjust to that to some degree. I don't expect them to fall off the map, but I think certainly when you lose your best player, the offense, you know, didn't seem equipped to adjust one night into that, and they really didn't have their roles defined. But all that being said, you know, Damian Lillard is still Damian Lillard, and you know, although he heated up late in the third and fourth quarter, the same thing for Wes Matthews, particularly in the third quarter. I thought that they, you know, overall played great defense on guys who are NBA stars. So I'd like to give them credit for that. I mean, the offense was not great at times tonight. Obviously, they only scored, 90 points in four quarters. So not a great offensive performance. But defensively, I thought they were studs. Evan Turner, not a guy known for his defense, was really, I thought, keeping Damian Lillard in check for the majority of the game. You know, they forced them to take bad perimeter jump shots. They were not hitting them early on and even when they started hitting them, Avery Bradley would still play good defense on Matthews and Damian Lillard, and they'd hit three-pointers that were contested. And granted, you know, Portland's known for hitting those kind of shots, and that's why they're a good team. But it's about as good a defensive performance as you might expect, particularly from this young team that's not really known for their defensive performances.
I think, honestly, the one thing that I noticed from this game that I don't watch. I'm not one of those kind of people that watches the NBA on a regular basis when it comes to just regular season games that aren't on primetime. I live out here. For those of you who don't know, I'm Chris Morrison, by the way. This is my first Boston postgame show that I've done, and this is the first game that I've watched of the Boston Celtics this year, considering they're not on national television. I live out here in the Pacific Northwest, about 40 miles south of Seattle. Obviously, there's not much basketball out here to watch anymore because the Sonics are not a normal thing because they're gone. And watching the Trailblazers, you would think, would be a logical thing to put on television here, but no one cares because this is 12th man country, as all of you know out there in New England and your deflated balls. First of all, I have a very objective mind. I think the whole deflated ball thing is disgusting. I think it's stupid. We're not going to talk about that here because obviously we have a huge game-winning three to talk about. But I just wanted to let you know I'm not a biased of opinion about that. I think it's an absolute joke. Anyway, the point is I live out here, I don't watch much regular season action in the NBA. And honestly, this is one of the first few regular season games outside of TNT, ESPN, that I have watched in quite a while. And I mean, probably since I was in high school. And that was about 10 years ago. And since then, watching this game tonight, I usually get up for these games, you know, big time matchups, whatever, on ESPN, TNT, expecting, you know, some crowd interactions, some hard play on television. And this game, it was really odd to me watching it. It almost felt like there was something missing the entire game. Almost as it's kind of like watching baseball. I hate to use different sports in the analogy, but it's almost like watching baseball. During the regular season, guys don't play to the capability that they can, you know, come like postseason, you know, teams like maybe the San Francisco Giants or anybody. When you watch the postseason, guys just amplify their game. But watching this game, this was kind of like another run of the mill, you know, just running your game on cruise control. That's what it looked like to me in this game. And so it was odd from that perspective, but watching the game as a whole, watching and seeing how the Portland Trail Blazers play, to me, as you were saying, it was a good defensive performance. For me, it looked like a bunch of guys chucking up threes. I mean, there were legitimately about 49 three-pointers thrown up. Well, 47 three-pointers thrown up in this game by both teams. Boston went 7 of 18. Portland went 9 of 29. And outside of the third quarter where the Portland Trail Blazers went 7 of 8 from 3, they went 2 of 21 the entire game. And from my perspective, it just looked like a bunch of bad open defended shots that they had no chance of getting out and going towards. And for that, it was just like, all right, you know, okay, this is just another regular season ball game. You know, we got a team in the Boston Celtics at 13-26, you know, and don't get me wrong. I mean, I understand it's the Eastern Conference and almost everyone except for the Knicks, and there's some other team in the East that's not very good. But the Knicks, outside of them and one other team that has 9 wins, I forget their name right now. But outside of those two, everyone's pretty much got a shot in the East to get to the playoffs. And Boston right now is about 2.5 games out of a playoff spot. I mean, again, they got to leap like 3 or 4 teams, but they're right there. And to see that, and to see that this team has a chance to get there at 14-26 now, 40 games into the season, don't call me crazy. But with a win like that, again, think about this. Since 2013, February 25th, that's like 23 months. The last time the Boston Celtics had a win like this against the Western Conference team on the road has been 23 months. There are children. There are more than there's like over a million, more than like hundred, like at least 10, 20 million children have been born since then, and kids who are growing up today who have seen the Boston Celtics, who have been horrible for the last 5 years, since 2010, since they last went to the finals. Since then, they haven't been anything, and this is a win that you've got to get excited for if you're a Boston Celtics fan. If you want to call in, 347-215-777. I think that's enough sevens. There's 3 sevens in there. 347-215-7771. And if you want to call in and talk Boston Celtics about a post game, we got it here for you. Let's break down the game for you real quick. Chamberlain, if you want to get in and jump in on this, I just got a quick recap of how the game went. I know I'm just kind of covering all spreads and stuff here, but I'm just going to break down how the game kind of went tonight. First of all, there were a lot of Celtic fans in Portland. It's crazy, man. I mean, I don't know if you've been out here often, Chamberlain, or how. Where are you from, Chamberlain?
Okay. I'm actually from Los Angeles, which is the reason why I'm doing the game with you, because we're both West Coast guys on this feed. Most of the Celtics guys are probably asleep right about now.
Oh, I got topics on topics, and we got things to talk about.
All right, let me in a couple of these, man.
All right, here we go. All right, real quick. Let's break down the game real quick, because I know everyone wants to hear about the game, because everyone's going to wake up in the morning and see that Evan Turner hit this game-winning three, and they're not going to know how it got to that point. So the first quarter, real quick, Damian Lillard came out aggressive. He got a little too aggressive. He was a little sloppy. Game again. Tons of Celtics fans out here, or at least Boston fans out here in the Pacific Northwest. I don't know why they come out here. Bobby feels like Boston to them, or maybe they're different or whatever or whatnot. And in the first quarter, again, Damian Lillard got aggressive. The Celtics took advantage of what they had inside. I mean, I saw plenty of plays that were occurring here in this game, at least early on, that the Celtics were trying to make the extra pass and get the ball inside to take advantage of the lack of presence with LaMarcus Aldridge out. Boston was up 23-19. And at the end of the first quarter, it looked like the Celtics were rolling. What did you see, Chamberlain, after the first quarter?
Yeah, I definitely saw a little bit of that. I mean, Thomas Robinson's sort of undersized. You know, Jared Sullinger is a matchup kind of guy where he can take advantage of guys like Robinson, who's not quite one of the bigger guys with long arms who can get up and block his shot. I thought they were running the offense through him and Bass a little bit, you know, getting the ball inside and then sort of swinging it back out. Like you said, they didn't, you know, not that LaMarcus Aldridge is, you know, the most intimidating interior presence, but certainly,
right.
You know, certainly having Robinson in there, is, you know, instead of him, makes them much smaller, and that sort of played into the Celtics' hands. Crowder's not a guy who I love offensively, but certainly, you know, he was playing the passing lanes a little bit early, getting his hands on some balls and playing some defense. I thought that helped them get out in the break as well.
Yeah, hopefully it wasn't deflated balls, because that's a big thing right there in Boston right now. Anyway, Kelly Olynyk, first of all, Kelly Olynyk got hurt in this game. Hopefully it's not for long term there in the fourth quarter. But I saw him pull up for three in the second quarter. Is that a normal thing he's been doing?
That is a normal thing in Brad Stevens' offense.
That's weird.
Yeah, Olynyk and Sullinger. Well, you said at the beginning of this conversation that you don't really watch the NBA. I mean, I would tell you is welcome to the NBA in 2015. You know, Portland
Holy
took 28 threes tonight. That's their average. They average 27.5 threes a game. That's how teams win these days in the NBA. They spread the floor and everyone needs to hit a three. I mean, you know, make of that what you will.
Yeah,
that's the modern.
It's not that I don't watch the NBA. I watch the NBA. I look at box scores. But I know what you're saying. I don't watch the NBA on a nightly basis because obviously the Sonics they're not here. But when it comes to, you know, watching games on you know, ESPN, TNT, definitely the playoffs. I mean, obviously the playoffs are a whole different ballgame. But watching games on nightly on ESPN, TNT, as much as I can consume from the national perspective, it baffled. Again, like you said, it is a new era. It's 2015, but man, it was ugly. I saw Myers Leonard pull up from three. Since when do guys who are like 7'1" with no ability just pull up from three? I know Matt. Those of you who don't know, I'm a huge Spurs fan. I grew up a Spurs fan. Yeah, all you people are probably thinking, oh, great, we got a front runner here on the radio. No. I was born in San Antonio. My dad put the Spurs hat on my head, and unfortunately, we've only missed the playoffs four times since 1976. I know. It's kind of a we're a Yankee team of the NBA. We're that good. I know. It's unfair. We're literally spoiled. We're the most spoiled fan base in the NBA. But when it comes to the Celtics and everything that they, I was baffled. I saw Kelly Olynyk pull up for three, and I was like, "Hold on, this isn't the same Kelly Olynyk I saw at Gonzaga." You know, he's out here in the Pacific Northwest. This was not the same guy that played down low. He played a physical game brand of basketball at Gonzaga. Yes, he did shoot from three at Gonzaga, but it was one of those kind of rare occasion type things. In this game, I saw him pull up like three or four times. I was like, whoa, this is a normal arsenal for him. So that was odd for me. Again, like I said, everyone was shooting threes in this game when it came to the Boston Celtics. They shot well. They shot well in the first half. They shot 50% from three. They went four of eight. I think maybe five of nine or at least four of nine. They were around 50%. They were doing pretty well from the outside, and that actually helped them again. Showed some elements of solid team basketball. I'm not going to lie. Like I said at the beginning of the show, watching the game, I saw some solid elements of team basketball that honestly I wasn't expecting watching this Celtics team. I know they have the pieces. They have some solid pieces. We'll get into a little bit of a roster talk here in a little bit about the Boston Celtics because there are some pieces that I really love about this team. But I saw the elements come together on several occasions in the second quarter where I was like, okay, you know, this team is not just the, you know, they're not just a team that's young and building and getting better. I mean, that's what they are, but they are definitely in rebuilding mode and in transition. But I think with the way they played tonight, and I know, again, they won on a three-pointer, but the way they played tonight, if you just kind of picked your poison and picked your elements of where to see from, you picked some bites, you saw some moments where you're like, wow, if this team puts it together and doesn't have lull periods like they did later on in the second quarter, they don't have lull periods, this team is legitimately a scary team to look out for in the future. And I know we'll get to this topic about Brad Stevens in a bit because I've heard a lot of people don't like him, and I got some stuff to talk about on that. But Again, I saw some solid elements of team basketball. I saw some excellent backdoor cuts for us by some guys, extra passes. They were looking to make the extra pass. There's a difference. When it comes to coaching and team and play in the NBA, things that I've noticed over the years as watching as a Spurs fan, and again, I feel like I have more of a biased opinion because I'm a Spurs fan and I watch them play in the postseason. When you play in the postseason, at least from watching it on a regular basis, you got to have a team that's looking to make the extra pass. It's one thing to do it just to do it, but it's another thing to actually seek out the extra man. When you have that first, second pass on the backdoor cut or on the cut towards the hoop or on the screen and roll, and then after the pass on the screen and roll, the extra pass, that is an element that you look, that you practice on as a team and as you build on as a team. It's not just something that you, you know, you just do at game time. It's something that you implement in your team success and in your program to build around for the future. And that's something that I saw on multiple occasions. It definitely wasn't a normal trend, but it was on certain instances where in between timeout breaks, I saw the Celtics really focusing in on solid fundamental basketball, fundamental passing, fundamental brandage of what team basketball should look like. And it was, there, like I said, solid cuts, solid moves, solid basketball plays, not individualized games, which we see most of the time in the NBA, but we saw a complete team game at some points. But then, as I'm sure you've watched this year, Chamberlain, there were some silly plays, a foul on Leonard as he was shooting a three in the second quarter, couple of turnovers, and this is again, and I want to get your take on that real quick, Chamberlain. What did you see in the second quarter when it came to the Celtics, their inconsistencies, when they showed that team ball, and then also when they showed those lull periods? What did you see?
Well, again, and I know you haven't followed this team that often. By the way, for the just so you're aware of this, I'm in fact a Lakers fan, so we can have an interesting conversation based on that if you'd like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we could do that.
Yeah, so you went on a little strong about the glory of the Spurs franchise a little earlier in the conversation. But, where are we at here? So, yeah, you know, this team, and you've talked about how you like a lot of the pieces. I'd like to get into specifics on that at some point if you'd like, because I'm kind of on the other side. I've done a lot of these. I'm kind of on the other side of that. I think that, you know, NBA players are capable. Obviously, these are all NBA players. They're all capable of having good nights, and many of them did tonight. But there are flaws in almost all of the players on the roster that are going to prevent them from being the type of consistent contributors that can play. You know, they're all, basically the guys on this team are by and large either matchup players or guys who are going to, like Evan Turner, for example. He's had an admirable year, considering, you know, that he's playing out of position essentially, but he is playing out of position. His court vision is not that great, and that's why at times he struggles as a point guard. He had four turnovers tonight. That's really the biggest problem with his team right now, is since they've traded Rajon Rondo, they don't actually have a point guard with court vision on the roster. Marcus Smart is technically a point guard, but again, he doesn't have that division either, at least not now. Avery Bradley is more of an off-ball player. He's good coming off screens, but you don't want him handling the ball. You saw what happened when he got out on that break with about 40 seconds left in the game, where he just fumbled the ball, you know, on a wide open pass. So this is definitely a roster with a lot of holes, and even the players that have talent, you know, also have weaknesses. So I think, you know, that's what happens to them, is they get in stretches where they just can't make shots because they don't have an individual player who's talented enough to score outside of the scheme. And you gave them credit earlier for, you know, running their scheme effectively, but, you know, that's just in spurts. Like, ultimately, the NBA comes down to, you know, when the other team, you know, defends what you're doing well, do you have a guy on your roster who can either bend the offense or find a way to create for himself when the offense breaks down? And this roster is definitely lacking that guy.
Well, we'll get to that in a second. I there's a lot there that I can pull from you when we get to that say, but I want to break down this game real quick first. Again, like you were saying about, you know, the spurts and the lack of the lull periods, I'd call them. I guess I disagree with you on the standpoint. I mean, I agree with you that they do not I definitely agree with you that they don't have a superstar player or a player to break that mold. I totally see that now as you break it down. But at the same time, those periods where they do run their scheme effectively, it is actually an effect. I think it's an effective scheme to run in the future. Yes, they do need a player to break that mold. Yes, they do need a couple pieces. I will 100% agree with you there. And I'm not saying that this current roster or that this current scheme of what they're running right now will be effective for the future. They definitely need to add pieces, and they need to add certain players to go from there. But the things I saw in this game that I was pulling from was, again, the difference between a good and a bad team are the teams that, like you said, that have that player, or they have that moment, or they have that alternate scheme that they can prove and pull out of a hat from time to time, and they can pull it out, and that's the difference between a good and a bad team. It really is that simple. If you have an extra cat in the hat, as I would say, an extra cat in the hat where you can, like, confuse the defense quickly and make them come off balance and off guard of what they're used to seeing. Like, what the Boston Celtics have is really only one scheme, maybe two, but they don't have three or four, and then maybe like a cat in the hat type thing where it's like, okay, we're going to pull this out at you every once in a while. They don't have that, but that's the difference between a good and a bad team, and tonight you saw that. And the lull periods they had, it wasn't the fact that they had lull periods and they turned the ball over late in the second quarter. It's the fact that if they just would have played safe basketball, and even if they would have missed shots and held the ball longer, you know, maybe lengthened out that shot clock, which they were doing most of the time anyway. But if they would have lengthened it out, maybe tried to make the extra pass, even a shot clock violation wouldn't have been the end of the world, because the thing about turnovers is that they can create fast breaks, they can create momentum shifts in a ball game, and with that, with those minor things and with the young team, that can impact a team for the rest of the game, especially at this point in the second quarter going into the half thinking, okay, well, we've struggled, we've lost this much, we've lost as much ground, you know, we've given up 6 points off turnovers in the last minute and a half, you know, and that can deflate a team. Well, the thing that was, like I said, in this game they had spurts of good moments, but then the points where they had moments of bad moments, that's the difference. And the bad moments, if they would have turn those instead of turnovers into at least attempting to get baskets inside or outside, or even maybe taking a bad shot instead of trying to force things and cause turnovers, that's where you decipher yourself from being a bad team to being an average team. And if they were to control it just a little bit better, I'm basically saying have like ball control. If they can find a way to have ball control and decrease those kind of turnovers and those kind of moments, this team could jump into a 500 role. And in the Eastern Conference, that's a playoff team. But the Celtics going into half, they led 44-42. Again, that's what happened. Right at the gate, teams were trading baskets. The Celtics were scoring right when they would score. It seemed like Wesley Matthews would come down the court and shoot a three-pointer. Something was going to, you know, every time the Celtics went down the score, Portland Trailblazers came down and scored. Again, like I said, I saw Myers Leonard pull up for three. It baffles me. I never see Myles Leonard pull up for three on ESPN or TNT, but that's another case. Jared Sollinger, and he pulled up for three too. What do you think about Jared Sollinger? You talked about him earlier. What is your take on him?
Well, first of all, Myers Leonard shoots like 40% from three. So, I mean,
wow.
Yeah, they let him. He doesn't take a lot, but when he does, he hits one or two a game. So,
okay.
Yeah, they'll surprise you. I'm telling you, man, this is just the modern NBA. They expect, like, if you're not a rim protecting center, like, there's two types of big men now. They're rebounding block shot big men, and there's big men who can stretch the floor and hit threes. And if you're not one or the other, you're not going to see any time in today's NBA. Kelly Olynyk had to extend his range to three-point range, especially in Brad Stevens' system, because he wants to spread the floor as much as possible and take threes. But unfortunately, yeah, the Celtics are, what, I think they are, let me check, they're 24th in the league in three-point percentage, even though they want to be a three-point shooting team, which is one of the reasons why they're not a very good team, because they can't actually shoot. But in regards to Sollinger, you know, there's a lot of people around Boston who take umbrage with the fact that Jared Sollinger does, you know, extend his range to the three-point shooting line, because he is, you know, somewhat of a guy who he gets a fair amount of offensive rebounds, and, you know, he is a post player that can, you know, he's kind of tricky inside, and he can get, you know, baskets that you don't expect him to get, and Celtics fans kind of just want him to camp out at the post and always man that spot and never take the three-point shot. And the fact of the matter is, he doesn't shoot very well from three at all. He shoots well below average, but in order for him to be an effective player, he needs to be able to pull his man outside, or at least project some sort of threat from the perimeter, because he's not going to be able to free himself up for those low post positions otherwise. He's more of a sneaky player when he gets inside. He's not, you can't expect Jared Sullinger, a guy who's undersized and unathletic, to be able to constantly get low post position and bully his way into baskets like Shaq did in the early 2000s. Like, it's unrealistic for Celtics fans to expect that. So, yeah, is Jared Sullinger going to have to pull out and take a bad three from time to time in order to positively affect the other aspects of his offense? He is, and that, you know, it's one of the negative aspects of what Jared Sullinger is, but he's also a guy who, because he does that, it makes some of the other things he does. When instead of taking that three, sometimes he'll try to take his man off the dribble, and he has, you know, a sneaky little move to the rim that works because people expect him to take that three. And if he stops taking them, then people are just going to lay off, and he won't have that move to the rim.
Yeah, the one thing I noticed when it came to the game as well, Nicholas Batum got hurt in the third quarter. He hurt his wrist or whatnot. I forget exactly what he did Yeah, his wrist. He got a wrist sprain. Exactly. Yeah, and at that ball game again with a bad Celtics team, but a Portland Trailblazers team again. One of the best teams in the NBA, second best in the Western Conference, losing now two. I'd say Nick Batum is their X factor, but LaMarcus Aldridge all by himself. This out, Nicholas Batum kind of needed to extend his game a little bit.
I need to jump in on you. Just to let you know, my phone's going to die, so I'm going to call you from a 818 number, okay?
Okay, that sounds good.
10 seconds. Okay.
Yeah. All right, he's going to hang up real quick, and so he'll be right back. Anyway, the point is Nicholas Batum got hurt. That's not going to help a team that is absolutely desperate when it comes to, you know, needing success when it comes to the NBA. Nicholas Batum has been a staple of the Portland Trailblazers for a long time, and with the way he has performed over the past couple of years, being the X factor that he is, the Portland Trailblazers is going to need him. And so for him to be out at the time that he was, definitely difficult for him to, definitely difficult for the Portland Trailblazers to lose him as well. We got Chamberlain back on. There he is. All right, cool. Awesome. Again, like I said, and you mentioned this, the NBA is a newer NBA with everyone shooting threes all over the place. That's pretty much what Portland did in the third quarter. Although instead of just shooting them everywhere, they were effective. They went 7 of 8 in the third quarter. Portland going into the fourth quarter was up 72-67. And this is kind of where, again, as you mentioned earlier, Chamberlain, when we were talking about the sequences that the Boston Celtics go through, whether they're sloppy, whether they're not, the things that were interesting, it was not just the Celtics. It was both sides that were very sloppy sequences. I mean, there was times where guys were coming up the court, and there was that one moment where with about 9 minutes left in the fourth where both teams were running up and down the court. There was like 2-3 possessions, and Boston just fumbled the ball like twice, and then Portland fumbled the ball or someone got blocked or whatnot, and no one could put the ball in the basket. It looked awful. It looked like two teams just trying to run out the clock in the fourth quarter, or at least trying to get this game over. That's what it kind of looked like to me, at least that point in the game. And then obviously the frustration by Walt McCartney and the Tech, that put Portland up 78-73 with about 9 minutes to go in the ball game. Then Marcus Thornton hit the three, which eventually changed back to a two, making it 78-75, Portland with about 8:45 left to go. Brandon Bass fell really hard to the court. I thought he was out. He looked like he was hurt real bad. And then shortly after that, Kelly Olynyk came back. Although Brandon Bass was fine, by the way. Kelly Olynyk sprained his right ankle. Hopefully that's all it is. Hopefully it's not anything more. And then Portland went on a small run. They were up 82-75 with about 6-7 minutes left in the ball game. And then that's when the Celtics started making a run. With about, you know, in the next 3.5 minutes, that was when the Boston Celtics found a way to tie the ball game up, making it 87-87. They went on a 10-3 run with about 3.5 minutes to go. And then that was when you brought up the Avery Bradley bobble. By the way, that looked like an outstanding outlet pass and fast break opportunity for the Celtics to make it an 89-88 game with about 42 seconds left in the game. And Avery Bradley bobbled the ball.
that again is youth, and that is, you know, that's just, that's the Celtics, I think, growing up and trying to get their, you know, trying to get their feet wet with these situations this late in the game against a good team. And maybe they're nervous, maybe they, maybe they're just not very good team, I don't know, but from what it looked like, it just looked like they were, they were really excited to be playing this well against the undermanned Portland Trailblazers team. What did you see there in the last minute of the ball game, Chamberlain?
Well, again, I realize this is part of a function of you not really having to watch 25 Celtics games a year, but the Celtics are notorious for being up or tied or behind just a couple points late in games and failing to close games out. That's part of the reason why there's a lot of criticism on the shoulders of Brad Stevens, at least locally. Nationally, he seems to be a beloved figure. But, yeah, one of those reasons is because his late-game play calling almost at times seems non-existent. You wonder what they're doing offensively. And you could even say that in this game, you know. Jared Sullinger did have that three in the final seconds of the game that I didn't have a problem with him taking. If we had callers tonight, which I'm sure we don't, but if we did, some of them might complain about that. But frankly, you know, Bradley got him a wide-open look, so I don't have a problem with him taking it. But I do have a little bit more of a problem with running a high post for Jared Sullinger with 8 seconds on the clock. That seems like if something develops out of that, it's going to take a long time to develop. And I don't like getting him the, like, you don't want to, you want a ball handler to have the ball in that position. You don't want a guy who's just going to pass from a stationary position or do a move that's going to be time-consuming. You know, he got the ball stripped from him immediately, luckily got it back and kicked it out to Turner for three, and it worked out. But as far as the play call itself goes, it was not ideal, in my opinion. I think that's reminiscent of what you see of the Celtics in a lot of situations like that, where you just scratch your head and you wonder why they're doing what they're doing in late-game situations.
And then, I agree with you. I actually did not agree with the play call as well. I mean, it was, first of all, with 26.6 seconds to go, when they did originally, right before that game-winning three by Turner, and I believe that was sloppy as well when Sullinger got the ball in the post with 8 seconds to go. But also with 26.6 seconds before that play before when they eventually called timeout with about 8 seconds to go, that was in a completely sloppy sequence of events.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I saw the ball flying around. I saw guys falling down, not knowing where to go, nervous, not seeing what part of the court they needed to be on. I was like, holy cow, this looks like a giant jumbled mess, and I had no idea what to expect. And then, obviously, with 8.5 to go, Sullinger got the ball down low, which, again, I don't agree with that idea, but you kind of brought it up yourself. This team doesn't have any superstars, so really, where else are they going to go? Yes, I agree. Put it in the hands of a guard. Put it in the hands of someone who can handle the ball up top and find a way to get a pick and roll, find a way to get something going up top so that you can make the defense rotate one way or the other. But at the same time, you know, if you don't have a superstar and you don't have the guy who can potentially move that around, then maybe a different option is the case. But yes, I agree with you in the whole. It was sloppy. It wasn't ideal. It wasn't conventional. But magic happened, and the Boston Celtics found a way to win 90-89, going now 14-26, 40 games to go. 40 games left in the season yet.
Yeah, I think if you get him the ball, you know, underneath the basket and he can't put it in, I think you can live with that. But at the elbow, it just doesn't really make any sense because he's still going to have to make some sort of offensive move to get closer to the basket or take a fadeaway jumper from that position, which I don't want you in Sullinger.
No, you don't. Yeah, I totally agree. I am in agreement with that all the way. I thought overall the ending of this game was, like you said, sloppy, but I think it was also a pretty miraculous win for the way the Boston Celtics got it done. I mean, you got to give them credit where credit is due. They did play great in that final 5 minutes of the ball game when they were down, and people forget they fouled Steve Blake at the 3-point line, and he made three free throws to make it 82-75. After that, the Celtics finished the game, and they were down 80. They were down 81. I forgot what. 82-75, and they went on a 15-7 run to win the ball game. I mean, that again, undermanned Portland Trailblazers team. If Portland had LaMarcus Aldridge and if they had Nick Batum healthy at the end of the game, guarantee you 82-75 would have turned into 96-80, but it didn't. And in this case, the Celtics took advantage. They found a way to win. Yes, they are an average ball club. That is what they are at best right now. but at the same time, an average ball club has a chance in the Eastern Conference, which, as I think you both know, is pitiful. The Eastern Conference is terrible. And for that, the Celtics still have a living, breathing chance. And knowing that they have a living, breathing chance, it is a good night in Boston. Now, topics. You brought up some things that I thought were good. The Boston Celtics roster. Again, you brought up how you didn't really, not that you didn't like the roster, but what is your take on the roster of the Celtics? I think I heard about it earlier, but I want to really hear from you.
Oh yeah, I'll come right out. I'll be definitive. Yeah, I don't like the roster. You know, ESPN does an NBA rank, and I've said this on another show before, but they do an NBA rank of basically all the players in the NBA up to 500, I believe. And you know, this is by no means a definitive ranking, but I like to use
right.
it to illustrate the point. You know, Rajon Rondo was on it around number 40, but obviously he was traded away. The highest player on NBA rank currently left on the Celtics roster is Avery Bradley at 109. Now, there are 30 NBA teams, okay? So if you just do the math, NBA rank thinks that Avery Bradley, the best player on the Celtics team, is an average number 4 on an NBA roster.
Yeah.
So if you're number 1 is an average number 4, then how good is your roster?
Yeah, it's not very good. That's a good take on it. I like that analogy. The thing I've been looking at though over the last couple of years, and again, I haven't been watching the Celtics. I am not a Celtics aficionado, but there's one thing that I want to give Celtics fans some hopes on that I really think that they should be looking forward to in the future. And I agree with you. The roster is not very good. And if we're talking 2014, 2015, which obviously this show is revolved around in this game alone, I agree with you. This roster is horrible. This roster sucks. But when it comes to the grand scheme, when it comes to the grand picture of what to look forward to in the future, yes, if you want to go forward with this roster by itself, absolutely. I disagree. I mean, I agree. It is a awful roster to go forward with. But that coming NBA free agency period, there are a ton of guys out there. And I'm not just talking about Marcus Gasol. I'm not just talking about the big name guys. There's a ton of guys out there who can help this team coming next year and help them become, now, I'm not saying a legitimate team in the East. I'm not saying a team that's going to contend for a title. I'm not talking about that. And I understand Boston is more known for its championship runs than it is its just playoff runs. I get that. And I understand that. But at the same time, with where they're at right now, they've got a lot of digging to do. I mean, they got a lot of climbing to do. Digging as in, like, they got to dig for some gems. They got to find some guys to revolve around. And a couple things that I do like right now of the roster when it comes to the grand scheme, not this year, because you mentioned a guy that I like, Avery Bradley. Again, I understand he's an average player right now, but the guy has been getting a little bit better. Every time I see him, he gets a little bit better, and I feel like he's improving. He can play both guard positions relatively well. Marcus Smart, I really like this guy, and it's not just because I watched him in college. I think this guy is a legitimate threat and could improve as a really solid role player in the future. Again, he's just going to be a role player. I don't see him being a superstar. I see him being a solid role player. And Kelly Olynyk is just getting better and better. I mean, I think he's going to get better and better. The guy is going to be playing for the international team. Hopefully, he's not going to be hurt. The international, you know, versus USA Rising Star game here in about a month. He'll be there, and it's for a reason. The guy is getting better. These guys are going to slowly get better if they put the work in. If these three guys put the work in and the Celtics find ways to build around them with the scheme that, again, we'll get into Brad Stevens in a second, but when it comes to the scheme that they're putting together, it spells a good future. I'm not saying a championship future, and I understand Boston's all about championships. I'm not trying to sit here and say that this organization is not about winning championships and that they don't care, because they do. This is what they do. This is what they're known for. I mean, the 60s and the 80s, this is what they're known for. And I understand that it's 2015 and it's a long time ago, and obviously 5 years ago when they had the big three, but that's what they want. And that's going to take some time, but with the pieces they got in place, I tell you what, 5 years from now, this might be a legitimate team in the East, but they've got, like you might even mention, they need to find some, they got to do some serious digging to get that stuff all situated.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you where I disagree with you. I look, Do I think that the team is hopeless? No, of course not. Gagne has put them in good position in several areas, notably, obviously, trading for a bunch of draft picks. They will be under the cap in this offseason, and I don't want to speculate now on how they'll be able to use that cap because, one, it's been notoriously difficult for Boston to sign free agents for whatever reason, and they actually have quite a hang-up about that in Boston. And two, you know, it also depends on the market and, you know, who's going to sign. The cap's going to jump after next season, so there's speculation that, like, a lot of guys aren't going to want to sign their long-term deals in this offseason because they'll wait for the cap to jump so they can sign larger contracts after next year. So who knows how all of that will play out. Maybe they'll be able to catch somebody good in the offseason, and I'll talk about what I think about the team then. The roster, as it's currently constructed, like, in my opinion, it's largely made up of a bunch of, you know, fifth starter types, six men, guys who, yes, they can play well, and they can play well with, you know, the right guy, but I think that you can't construct your role players before you know who your stars are because you don't know whether or not your stars are ideal fits with those role players. You know,
well,
know whether or not this team is on its way, they need their, you know, they need their Anthony Davis, or they even need, not even their Anthony Davis, they need their John Wall. You know what I mean? They need the guy who's good enough to carry, you know, be the lead guy to carry a team to the playoffs, because right now none of these guys are ever on this particular team are ever going to be quite good enough to be that guy.
No, I agree. I agree with you. No one on this team is good enough to become a superstar player. I am in full agreement with that. I just think that from the and again, it's how it's currently constructed though. But you gotta have something. When it comes to this team, you knew that the moment that Brad Stevens was signed, this was going to be a long-term project. You knew it was going to be a long-term project. This wasn't going to be a, you know, instant fix. This wasn't going to be a team that was going to be good in 2 years from the time he was signed. You knew that wasn't going to be the case. You knew that this was going to take some time. You knew there was going to need to be some giant bumps in the road where, you know, maybe this team was going to have to go through some horrible years. And this isn't a horrible year by anyone's standards, but it's definitely not a average year or a acceptable year by Celtics, by real Celtics standards. I think anyone could be in agreement with that. But knowing that they signed Brad Stevens, knowing that they have the piece, and I understand your philosophy. I actually completely agree with your philosophy to a degree. I agree with it to a degree because, yes, I understand the aspect of building around superstars. You would know that as a Lakers fan, Shaq and Kobe. Kobe in 2010, 2011, or 2009, 2010. You would understand the big four that they had the year they played against the Pistons, unfortunately, where they got swept. But that was a really good team, and they built that team around that fortune. I mean, obviously, they had had the 2000 dynasty, the 2000 through 2002 dynasty that they had to work from. But I get where you're pulling from. The thing that I'm pulling from, though, that I see where this team's going, and I get that where you want the superstars to be built around, but what makes this better, and again, I'm going to pull a San Antonio Spurs analogy on you, because look at this team. Yes, the Spurs have not been as good this year as they've been over the past 15 years in the Tim Duncan era. You can make the case that this has been one of the worst teams in Spurs in the Tim Duncan era, but here's the thing that they did last year that people don't really recognize when it comes to how they played. The Spurs last year had a lot, and they've done this year too. They've done this for like the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years now. With players, the older players, they don't play very often. The superstars don't play at all. So what do? They play the role players constantly. What do? They throw Corey Joseph out there to play 15 minutes a game. They play Austin Day, who unfortunately got let go, which is I still don't understand. But they let Austin Day play. They let other guys like Matt Bonner. Matt Bonner will start random games, and they'll still beat solid qualified NBA teams that should be playoff teams. They'll beat them in the regular season. What does that do? That builds their confidence. That gives them game experience. That gets them time on the court. That makes them better just by experience-wise, and that gives them that. And I completely agree with you that this team right now and with where they're going isn't constructed to do anything. Like, if they literally just pull draft picks, like you were saying, again, they have a lot of draft picks over the next 5 years. If they just pull draft picks and they don't get anyone in return, then yes, the Brad Stevens era will be a failure. I 100% agree with that. And obviously with the market and Boston's market to pull free agents, if they can't pull the free agents they need to make this team more complete, I agree with you. Then there's obviously no chance that this team has. And I 100% agree with you in that perspective. But if they pull together, let's say, a big man, they get a score guy, a guy who can score 20 points a night. And I'm talking like 20 points with maybe 5 assists, a guy like that, a guy who can, another big man to complement Kelly Olynyk or something like that as a better starter, you know, someone who's been solidified as a solid NBA player, or maybe even just a tad bit better to maybe rise his game to a stardom level. You add those kind of guys into the mix over the years and the pieces start fitting together and the role players that are role players all right now, because everyone's role player on the Celtics. No one's a star. But if all the role players pull together and then they get that one or two stars, bam, they instantly become a team where they can win 40, maybe 45, and we're dreaming, but 50 wins. If that all comes together over the years. Right now, hell no. Right now, there's no chance. And I agree with you on that. But there's a but.
Yeah, I have a couple problems with your Spurs analogy. One, I think we can acknowledge now that Greg Popovich is a bit of a witch who can accomplish things that, you know, we've historically seen no other NBA coach accomplish. So to expect Brad Stevens, you know, as good as he's been so far, to expect him to be another Greg Popovich, I mean, that's a stretch, in my opinion, to any imagination, because there's other teams who have tried playing as Spurs played. Obviously, their model is affecting, you know, what's going on in the NBA right now. So yes, there are other teams who are trying that same thing. And by the way, they're trying that same thing with more talented players, which, you know, you can run a Spurs system. Obviously, if two teams are running the same system and sharing and, you know, doing whatever it takes, if you have the talent that maximizes what you can do in that sharing system, you're going, look at what the Warriors are doing this year. They're playing in that, you know, move the ball around, everyone shoots, spread the floor, kind of system that Popovich has popularized, and they're destroying the league because they have they have more shooting talent than other teams do. They play the same way that the Spurs do, except their perimeter shooters are insane. So, are they going to win the title this year? Who knows? But my point to you is that, like, talent is ultimately going to rise to the top. And yes, this is even the case in the Spurs system. Like, Tony Parker, you know, even last year and even this year, you know, you can argue that he's starting to slip a little bit, but he might be one of the most underrated players of all time. Like, the Celtics don't have anybody approaching his stratosphere. Kawhi Leonard, one of the best all-around players in the league. Tim Duncan, on a per-minute basis, sure, obviously Popovich doesn't care about the regular season, and he's been an innovator in terms of resting his guys and maximizing what they do in the playoffs, but he still knows how to maximize them in the playoffs. And that's how they won. Right. They won the NBA title. You're right. It doesn't matter. Somehow he gets things out of, you know, 11th, 12th men that other coaches don't do. But I don't think that you can say, you know, Popovich does it, so anybody can win with anybody off, you know, off their bench, because historically that's not proven to be the case.
I think, yeah, well, you're right, and I agree. But I agree. And at the same time, though, with Brad Stevens, the thing that boggles me, and I want to get your take on, I think I've already heard it, but I want to hear kind of a more in-depth analysis. My thoughts on Brad Stevens, and I'm definitely more of the national perspective on Brad Stevens. First of all, this guy, and I get where Celtics fans are frustrated with him, and I saw bits and pieces of it tonight, and I won't deny that, yes, there are some things that maybe he needs to fix, or maybe the Celtics need to look into on him maybe finding a way to improve. But Brad Stevens is a guy where he brought a no-name, let's be honest here, he brought a no-name Butler team to two back-to-back NCAA championships. And I understand, college basketball is literally like little league basketball compared to the NBA. I completely understand that. It is not the same game. All you got to do is sit in front of a TV and watch college basketball for 5 minutes and sit in front of a TV and watch NBA for 5 minutes, and you will see a massive difference. It is just a completely different ball game, and it's just no comparison. But when it comes to getting something out of his players and getting the consistency and getting the work ethic and getting the getting the most out of what he can do with the talent that he has. You can't, you cannot question that if he can help a team like Butler get through an NCAA tournament 2 years in a row with the talent that he had. Yes, he had Gordon Hayward, and yes, I think he had one other guy, but he had two solid players on that team. Outside of that, they had a whole bunch of little babies running around, and they competed with some of the best teams in the country. Why? Because their scheme was great. And yes, again, the scheme in the NBA doesn't matter. I get it. It really all depends on talent, and I get that. But at the same time, if you've got a guy who's got a arithmetic or a type of thing that he can revolve around and then ultimately get to the NBA and find a way. And he's doing that right now. He's finding a way. And I'm not saying he's the next, you know, Phil Jackson, Pop, whoever the famous coach for the Celtics back in the day. Man, I'm blanking. I cannot believe I can't remember his name. But I'm not saying he's the next one of those. What I'm trying to say is that he's so early and young in his NBA career. I believe this is his second full year in the NBA. And with what he's done so far to this point, with the talent that he has, he's doing all he can with the talent he has. If he had a scorer, if he had two good players like he did at Butler, I guarantee you this team would be at 20-25 wins right now. They'd be up there in the conversation in the Eastern Conference as a top five, top six team. I wouldn't say a home court advantage team, but they'd be in there with the Miamis, the Brooklyns, and the Detroits. They'd be in there, and they already are in there with the Detroits. But the thing is if you give him some more time, if you give him a chance to give what he got, and give him some dang talent. I mean, come on. This guy has nothing to work with. And with nothing to work with that, what he has, he's led this team to a 14-26 season halfway through this year. And they are still in the chase. Again, two and a half games out of a playoff spot. Again, terrible Eastern Conference, and I understand Boston, if they do make the playoffs, will go nowhere. They will get swept in the postseason. I am not in any – if they make it, they will not compete in the postseason at all, period. But with what they have, Brad Stevens is doing all he can, and I agree with you. He is not maximizing and getting to where he needs to get to yet. But that is the national perspective saying that he has a chance. What are they saying in Boston about Brad Stevens that they don't like?
Well, I'm somewhere between your position and what you're perceiving the Boston position to be on Brad Stevens. Because, first of all, I think that it's unfair to, like, even include the Butler situation in the conversation, because certainly he did a good job there, but Rick Pitino did a good job at Kentucky, but he didn't do a good job with the Celtics. I think that you can look at each situation individually and evaluate it. And nobody's saying that Brad Stevens is an idiot and he can't coach, but just because he can coach doesn't mean that he's necessarily doing a good job with the Celtics, nor does it mean he's doing a bad job with the Celtics. I think that the big issues with him, one, are his rotations, which I have to take some issues with, because I'm not sure if he's in sync with what management is trying to do. You know, Danny Ainge traded away Rajon Rondo, got Jarrell Wright back as part of the deal, then moved him for another pick, traded Jeff Green away for nothing for a pick as well, but no players that can help the roster this year, with the idea that he doesn't want to make the playoffs. Otherwise, if Danny Ainge wanted to make the playoffs, then he would have held on to the guys who, his best two players, the guys who are going to help him make the playoffs. So it seems to me that the organization's priority is within rebuilding and getting draft picks, which is fine. But if Stevens is going to play under that mantra, coach under that mantra, he's got to coach with the understanding that his primary role is to develop the young players and make them better. And if that's the case, it doesn't make any sense for him to play Tayshaun Prince 24 minutes in a night like tonight. Well, yeah, granted, they won the game, but is that more important than developing younger players, considering what management's trying to do in the situation? I'm not sure. But moreover, he's not consistent at all with his minutes, and you'd like to see, at this point, we're halfway through the season, you'd like to see him get a rotation. Tyler Zeller has been starting for most of the year, and all of a sudden he's on the bench, and Brandon Bass is starting, played 31 minutes tonight, Tyler Zeller 16 minutes, Kelly Olynyk will play, 12 minutes, and then he'll play 34 minutes the next night. same thing with Jared Sullinger. He'll play 14 minutes and then he'll play 35 minutes. And it's really not fair to the players and their development. It's done to them. Not, you know, guys don't know what their roles are. Sometimes guys are point guards. Sometimes guys are off guards. And, you know, some nights is what I really mean to say. Not, you know, when they're playing with some guys, because obviously you expect dudes to play multiple positions. But, I mean, some guys are expected to have more ball-handling roles, and then other nights are expected to play off the ball. And it's just like, if you're trying to build a team here, I personally would like to see more consistency, or at least, you know, at this point in the season, have some idea of how you want to develop this team. And I think that's a fair criticism, as well as, you know, what I said earlier about their late-game situation. And, you know, a lot of people are critical of his use of timeouts, but I wouldn't be critical of that.
I could see that. You know, I haven't been watching games, but I have been looking at box scores on a regular basis. And when I do look up Boston Celtics box scores when they play games, I do notice that guys like Crowder, guys like Zeller, guys like even Olenek or even Marcus Smart, they'll have games where they play like 30 minutes a night, and then they'll have a game where they play five. It's like, okay. Why? You know, and you wonder that, and
right.
You question, okay, why are guys like Marcus Smart not playing? He is legitimately a guy. If you're going to, you know, I'm not saying the Celtics are not building around anybody right now. I mean, realistically, they don't have a guy talented enough to build around someone to, like we've said earlier, but a guy like Marcus Smart is a critical piece, I think, to starting to build that bench or that role player mentality of what the Celtics have, at least right now. And with him getting inconsistent minutes, or even not just him, but guys like you said, Tyler Zeller's a fantastic role player. They have a lot of fantastic role players on this team. But if you're going to give them inconsistent minutes and not try to build something of a regular rotation or regular type of mentality, I can see how that would irk a lot of Boston Celtics fans or just the fan base in general. So I can totally understand that perspective. But at the same time, I think that is, and again, this comes to the balance of him not doing something wrong or him doing something right, but just kind of where the criticism lies for Brad Stevens, at least I think nationally, is the guy is still trying to figure out his way in the NBA. And yes, it has been a year and a half. And yes, he's still new at this. But like you said, and I partially agree, you know, he might need to just have a more consistent basis, regular rotation to make that. And I totally understand that. And I totally understand that perspective. Okay, let's get away from Celtics for a second. What do you have to say?
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, I've made this point before too, but I think when you evaluate, you know, someone as a coach particularly, like, it should always be in flux. And I don't think that Stevens is a great NBA coach right now, but could he be down the line? Sure. And I would also say that I also don't think it's fair, and I agree with you on this point, to evaluate a coach simply by wins and losses. And that's why I didn't bring up either one when I discussed my criticism of him, because, yeah, this team is clearly not a talented team, and, you know, they're playing about as well as you would expect given the talent, arguably, you know, even a little better at this point.
Yeah. I agree with that. Let's get away from that for a second. All-star selections were picked today, and I have beef with one of them, with one of the starters, and I'm pretty sure you can guess on who I might have beef with. Although in the way, let's just tell them real quick. First of all, there was no Boston Celtics. Oh, that sucks. Anyway, okay, the Eastern Conference, the starters were Kyle Lowry, well-deserved. John Wall, well-deserved. Paul Gasol, I mean, honestly, the Eastern Conference is pretty terrible when it comes to picking guys for the All-Star game, but Paul Gasol is probably the best big man right now. Maybe outside of Joakim Noah. I mean, Paul Gasol is the most talented offensive, maybe not the most talented, but he's up there with one of the most talented offensive players in the East for big men. And then obviously LeBron James. Carmelo Anthony gets the nod because he's the key, the marquee player from New York, which, I mean, isn't much to brag about these days, but that's who's there in the East. And then in the Western Conference, this is where I got beef. Steph Curry is starting. Anthony Davis is starting. Blake Griffin starting. Marc Gasol starting. I think maybe DeMarcus Cousins should have started. Kobe is starting over James Harden. Are you serious, fans? Are you blind? I understand L.A. is a top two market in the NBA. I understand that that New York is definitely is up there as well, and I get that Melo starting. But Kobe Bryant should not be starting over James Harden. James Harden is up there with an MVP candidacy. If there's any guy right now in the MVP race that deserves to be at the starting in the All-Star game, James Harden is right there. I understand his defense isn't that good. I understand he lets guys blow by him. But when he gets the ball and he's out in the open court, Who else can be stopped? James Harden is up there as one of the best players in the NBA, and he is. I don't understand how the fans don't see it. I know he finished right behind Kobe, but you got to be kidding me with this. What is your take on this? Is Kobe starting over James Harden?
Well, I'm not nearly as upset about. In fact, I have more of an issue with Pau Gasol, which I'll explain why in a moment. But
yeah.
here's the thing: the All-Star starters is a popularity contest. That's why it's picked by the fans. So if the fans want Kobe Bryant, who's basically one of the most popular players in the NBA, it makes sense to me, and I don't have a problem with it because one, Kobe's not going to play in the All-Star game anyway. He's been injured for a long stretch of time. And two, again, if the fans want to see him play, he wasn't going to get into the All-Star game otherwise. I have more of an issue when I see who the coaches pick. You know, egregious choices, the guys that are left off, like Steph Curry, you know, not being picked for the All-Star game a couple years ago. James Harden's going to make this team. I don't weep for James Harden. James Harden's, you know, style of basketball is extremely frustrating and unappealing to the eye. You know, so if fans don't want to see James Harden play basketball, I can't really blame them for that. I have more of an issue with Pau Gasol because why is Pau Gasol popular? Like, who cares about Pau Gasol at this point in his career? Like, I feel like it's Bulls fans just, you know, stuffing the ballot box, and only the city of Chicago really wants him in that situation. Otherwise, it'd be somebody like a Paul Millsap or somebody else who is also
Al Horford.
Yeah, do I think that All-Star fans are really clamoring for Pau Gasol? I find that hard to believe, whereas do I think that fans want to see Kobe in the game? Yeah, I do, but I don't think if I asked the average NBA guy on the street, like, do you really want to see Pau Gasol in this game, that the answer would be yes. I think the answer would be I don't care. So that's why I don't know why we need Pau Gasol starting.
Well, at the same time, I mean, Pau Gasol is an all-star based on Eastern Conference standards. There's a lot of guys in the West that should be all-stars, but considering that the Eastern Conference is so – they just have so much bad talent when it comes to picking guys for a 12-man roster. That's when you know that realignment in the NBA needs to happen. When you have – it's not just the standings. It's when you have the entertainment – the biggest entertainment buzz of the regular season, which is the all-star game. And you have, like, it's tough to pick 12 men in the East because of how bad the Eastern Conference is when it comes to picking talent. I'm not saying there's, like, a ton of bad players in the East. It's just this year, there haven't been very many players who have been good in general. And so for that, it's just, like, really tough. I mean, I made my picks. I have this show called The Hoopers Log, and it's on Blog Talk Radio, by the way. And I made my all-star picks, and when I was picking 12 guys from the East – I had to pick up a guy like Greg Monroe. I just threw him in there because there's no one else to pick from. I mean, I picked Al Horford, Paul Millsap, and Jeff Teague. They should all be there. But outside of that, it's like, well, who else are you going to put in there after like 11 guys? Greg Monroe, Andre Drummond, he's awful.
Drummond's a better choice.
You think Drummond's a better choice? Drummond's a fantastic rebounder, but who wants to see him shoot a free throw in the All-Star game? I don't want to see him shoot a free throw in the All-Star game. Like, he's going to miss everything. He might even hit someone in the stands. He's that bad of a free throw shooter.
You don't have to worry about that because nobody's going to foul him at the All-Star game. Nobody commits fouls at the All-Star game. So
right.
You're gonna have a pick and roll dunk or two from Andre Drummond. And those are always nice to see. But
someone might have him just be fun, but yeah.
Yeah, I actually think that the disparity between the conferences in this case is going to work to make more exciting basketball because you look at the Western Conference and all eight teams are going to be awesome. They're all going to be essentially evenly matched and, you know, broken up by only a few wins. And the same is going to apply for the East. All of those teams are around the same quality. And even though, you know, they're not as good overall as the Western team, that's still going to be a dogfight. You know, and we're only going to end up with one bad series, which is going to, I mean, you know, possibly more, but just practically in terms of talent relation, one bad series, which is going to be the NBA Finals. in which case, okay, that's one bad series. Whereas if we realigned, then, you know, we'd have all the good, the best teams from the West play all the worst teams from the East in the first round, and we'd have, you know, four or five bad series. So in that respect, I'm kind of okay with it.
Yeah, I see that. I just feel like realignment's going to be coming soon eventually, and I think it needs to. I see where you're coming from in the playoff perspective. That makes sense. But at the same time, I mean, if you want to expand business and make it better, you don't have to, but when you consistently have teams in the Eastern Conference in the 8th, 7th seed who are below 500, and this has been going on for like a decade now, where like a team from the Eastern Conference makes it below 500 and it's just a regular expected thing. I mean, that all by itself just spells realignment. I mean, again, it's not like that bad, but last year, like the Western Conference beat the East. Like, weren't they like 75 or 80% winning percentage over the, like, that's ridiculous. Like, that all by itself is like, you got to fix something. And now with the Western Conference, with all the points, I mean, think about this. There's like legitimately 12 teams in the Western Conference that have superstar point guards. Like, you can't pick a Western Conference team. Like, I'm not a Western Conference team. Every single night, if a West team is playing a West team, there's no night off for a point guard. Like, there's these guys, when they get to the postseason, they're going to be absolutely worn down with how much talent is in the Western Conference at the point guard position. And if all you did was realign it, yeah, there'd be a lot more in, you know, said conference, let's say the East Conference, if it's not the East, call it something else, and put some Western teams in there, whatever, then it might be a little bit different. And I'm not just saying that, you know, just because of one position or whatnot, but I'm just saying, like, you could have more different conferences and have these guys facing off in different parts of the, you know, playing a team four times instead of two times, you know, like when an East team plays a West team, they only play twice, sometimes three, but mostly twice.
Well,
I don't know. It's just, there's a lot of things going into consideration with that.
Yeah, I think it wouldn't actually be a realignment, but it would probably, because in a realignment situation, you would end up eventually still having the same problem, potentially. Well, one team, you know, who's to say that the teams that switched from the East to West aren't the teams that improve, and then some West teams go down or whatever the new conferences are called, eventually you'd have inequity in those cases, too. I think far more likely would be, you know, just dissolving the conferences entirely and playing a 1-16 style tournament, but we'll see how that plays out in the future.
Yeah, most definitely. Okay, away from the Celtics, you're a Lakers fan, I'm a Spurs fan. Okay, so there's one thing about me that still irks me to this day, because I remember exactly where I was. I was sitting on the floor in agony, because when it comes to my Spurs, I get way into it in the postseason, and there's one thing that irks me to this day, and that is point four. Back in 2004 when Derek Fisher hit that shot. To this day, I still don't think it counted. And I don't know how you're going to react. I don't know how you react to that, but I don't know. All I know is that didn't count. Also, I have been hearing a lot of things from Laker fans over the years, which I think are fair criticisms, but at the same time, I think they're a little bit outlandish about Greg Popovich and how the Spurs are run. What is the opinion in Lakerland about the San Antonio Spurs?
To give credit to the Spurs as far as that point four play goes, a lot of people don't remember the 18-foot fadeaway jumper that Tim Duncan made.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember that.
But they had the ball with, I believe, a second and a half left, and Duncan hit that jumper to get it to point four. So that was an amazing shot in and of itself. The point four situation, it's like, yeah, you could say he can't get a shot off in point four, but, you know, the NBA has legally defined terms for a reason that say, you know, anything 0.3 or below, you're only allowed a tip-in, and technically you can get a shot off with 0.4 or more, because the bottom line is the clock is run by timekeepers, and those timekeepers still need to, like, wait till a guy catches the ball to start the clock. So just by reaction time alone, did he get that shot off in 0.4 seconds? No, but that's not how the clock works in any situation. Like, the time's not going to be started until the ball hits his hand, and there's still going to be a little half a second delay just because the guy, it takes him that long to hit the button. So, do I think he got the shot off in 0.4 seconds? No, but that's how it works in every NBA game. So I don't think it's any violation of the rules. But as far as how Laker fans feel about Popovich, Laker fans tend to dislike the Spurs. I haven't I haven't really heard, you know, a lot of negative talk about Popovich, because really, again, how much negativity really is there about the guy at this point? I think you know, as far as I can speak for myself in saying that I number one, I find him hilarious, but I think he's very entertaining, and I respect everything he does, but the Lakers and the Spurs obviously have a rivalry, so I don't root for the Spurs to win. In fact, I root for them to lose. And a lot of that has to do with there's also a historical rivalry sort of between Duncan and Kobe. Whereas, although they're not the same type of player, so a lot of people don't think about it, but they have the same number of titles. There's also a historical rivalry in that sense between the Lakers and Spurs, or, you know, the dominant team of the, you know, since Kobe and Duncan were drafted, essentially. So in that respect, you know, I rooted against the Spurs winning their last title, because then, you know, now that basically ties
Timmy tied him
the Kobe Bryant. Yep. Yeah, exactly. So in that respect, I think the Lakers fans, you know, root against the Spurs kind of for that reason, but I don't think that there's any direct animosity outside of that.
It's really fantastic. It's really fascinating how the rivalry of the Lakers and Spurs has evolved over the years, especially with Kobe and Timmy. And like you said, I'm glad you think of it that way too, because I've always thought of it that way. You know, ever since Kobe won his first three, and at the time, people weren't thinking of it that way. People were thinking of it as in, you know, the Lakers had just won three in a row. Tim Duncan had won title, you know, okay, whatever, you know, after they won their third in a row, it was like, okay, you know, great. You know, Shaq's got his three-peat, and you know, at the time, Shaq was really the guy on that team. Kobe was just the Dwayne Wade of the team, and, you know, people, you know, but
I'm going to correct you a little bit there, because I don't know. I mean, as a Spurs fan, I don't know if you remember those series, but Shaq actually struggled against the Spurs, because Robinson and Duncan gave him trouble, and Kobe was the guy who went off against the Spurs when they swept him in 2001. I think he averaged, I want to say, 36 points in that series, and then you know, the next year when they hit the point four, Kobe was also the leading scorer against the Spurs on that team. Shaq was the finals MVP because the Eastern Conference teams they went up against didn't really have centers to match up with him. But if you look at the way they played in the Western Conference playoff, Kobe played just as well or even better in some series than Shaq did.
Yeah, I agree with you in the fact that Kobe, I would say once 2004, like the year the Spurs won it in 2003, that was when Kobe started making his real, he was really making his presence in the NBA, especially in the 0-2 finals when they beat the Nets. That was when he really was, like, you know, side by side with Shaq. The first couple, you could make the case, it was kind of like, maybe, but it was definitely more Shaq. But yeah, I'd say in 2003, that was, or 2002 when they won their third title out of all of them, then Kobe was definitely side by side. But I just remember, like, as it evolved, you know, obviously once Timmy won MVP and they won the title in 2003 and Tim Duncan had the year he had in 2002-2003, that was when I started seeing that, like you were saying, Tim Duncan versus Kobe, because at the time Kobe had three, Tim had two, and then obviously in 2004 when the Lakers went to the finals off point four, they lost to the Pistons, and then the Spurs won in 2005, and then they tied it, at least Tim tied it, with three, and Kobe had three. That was when I started thinking, wow, Kobe, and that was, you know, once 05 had gone by, Kobe had his 81 points. Kobe was, you know, I think he had won an MVP by then, right? Was it 04 he won their MVP, or was it 05 he won the MVP? I forget. Or was it 06?
No, it was 07, actually.
It was 07, yeah. He should have won MVP a couple of those years. We know that. But because Steve Nash is just, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, those were ridiculous. Anyway, Kobe was like the premier player in the NBA at that point, and Tim Duncan was he was up there with other guys, but he was definitely still the best power forward in the league with KG when KG was in his prime, but Timmy was really the main guy. And so you kind of started seeing that, you know, Tim has three, and then obviously Shaq won his fourth with Dwayne, but then obviously Tim won his third in 05, and then he won in 07. So he won his fourth, and it was like, okay, Timmy's now better than Kobe, because Kobe was that good. And people forget now because, you know, it's been 10 years. But people forget Kobe was that good back then. That it was like, wow, he is the, you know, second coming of MJ. And he might be the, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then the next thing you know, and then in 09, when the Lakers won the championship over the Magic, and then they won it against the Celtics in 10, Kobe had 5 rings. And at that point, the Spurs, everyone in everyone's mind, even my mind as a Spurs fan, we had fallen off. I honestly thought we wouldn't win a title ever again after 07, especially when we got knocked off by the Grizzlies in 2011. 2011, when we got knocked off by the Grizzlies in the first round, 8-1, that was when I thought we were done. That's when I thought our window was closed. That's when I thought everything was over. And I was ready to concede that Kobe was the best player of the decade or the best player of his generation. And then all of a sudden, Tim Duncan turned into 27-year-old Tim Duncan within the last 2 years because of the rejuvenation that Pop has given him by not the season. But, you know, he then turned into, you know, the Tim Duncan of 10 years ago, a guy with some finesse moves, definitely not as fast as he used to be, but guy with still the fundamental moves, still making plays, even improving at the free throw line, which a lot of people forget. Tim Duncan used to be dreadful at the free throw line. He'd shoot 65, 70% from the free throw line, and that was on a good day, you know, and so he improved immensely later on in his career. And that's where, like you were saying, you know, people being, you know, upset at Tim Duncan and all that. And the more impressive thing as a Spurs fan, which to me is still, it still blows my mind, because in this era that we're in the NBA right now, where the high market teams are garbage, and the Knicks and the Lakers, which just was, I mean, the Knicks are a different story, but the Lakers were great forever up until about 3 years ago. They were great. And then all of a sudden, they just, like, Dwight Howard wanted to leave. No one wanted, I mean, Dwight Howard's a whole different case. But the point is like, players didn't want to play in L.A. And that's weird. Like, players love the fuck to L.A. And that's the odd part. And to see that happening, and to see that they haven't been any good in the past 2 years. Granted, Kobe was hurt last year. But in the last 3 years, they really haven't been any good. And to see the Spurs still there with the core players that they have, it is unbelievable. And I'm not just trying to, like, laugh, but it's just the facts. They do this every single year. And to see the Lakers be as bad as they've been, and I mean, they're awful this year, but they're not awful like they were last year, but to see the Lakers be where they are, and granted, yeah, they lost their owner and they're in kind of transition with the management situation that they're in right now. Obviously, Kobe's really near the end of his career. He's going to retire soon. To see them be as dreadful as they've been, it is so odd, because, like I said, that rivalry between the Lakers and the Spurs in the mid-2000s, people don't know. Like, kids these days, kids do not understand. From 99 until, what, 2012, actually, since 99, it has been, think about this, 99, Spurs, Lakers, 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 Spurs, Lakers, Spurs, Mavericks, Lakers, 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 Spurs, Thunder, Spurs, Spurs. It has been the Spurs and Lakers representing the Western Conference outside of 3 or 4 years since 1999. This has been the century of L.A. and San Antonio. And since the Lakers have been so bad recently, the Spurs have reluctantly found a way to get to the finals, which still blows my mind. I don't know how we're doing it. But it's unbelievable how that has transcended and how it's transpired.
Yeah, I'll tell you something that'll blow your mind. The Lakers have been in, I think it's still more than half. It might be less now, but it's right around half the finals in NBA history.
That's absolutely crazy. Well, you know, and the other crazy thing is, I mean, the Lakers have been in a lot of finals over the last at least 15, 16 years. And, you know, as we're here sitting on Celtics post-game radio show, I mean, the Boston Celtics, I mean, for us, especially us, and definitely kids who maybe even are listening to this, or at least young people listening to this, man, the Celtics of the 60s, and yeah, it was a whole different era, but the Celtics of the 60s, as we know, they absolutely ran train on everything. And that's why that's why all they do is hang banners in their arena, because that's all they care about is championship basketball. Well, Chamberlain, I don't know if you want to ask me any questions or talk about anything. Do you want to say anything?
Well, just to add on to your thing about Tim Duncan, I think it's sort of hard for me to completely evaluate Duncan as a player because I find that he's never been as statistically dominant as has actually reflected his talent. You know, by design, obviously. So, but if you're going to, you know, try to put Duncan in and, you know, where he ranks on the all-time list, it's hard to say because I feel like, again, because he was so unselfish, because, you know, some nights he did one thing, some nights he did another thing. You look at his numbers, and in a way, not that they're pedestrian, but for, you know, a top 10 all-time player, they're certainly pedestrian. So it's like, you know, I don't, and I realize there's obviously the championships that you can look at, but I guess you can counter that by saying, you know, obviously he wasn't, Tony Parker was probably the best player on their last title, right? Other than that, was Duncan the best player on the other four teams? Maybe you could make an argument. Although in 07, I think Duncan, you know, destroyed the Cavaliers in that series. So
everyone destroyed the Cavaliers.
Yeah, but I mean, so it's like I realize he was a much better player than even his numbers led on. But it's hard to make that specific argument without the numbers to back it up. It's interesting.
I think the best way to look at
was
Duncan
much better than
is
KG, but his numbers are essentially the same as KG. You know, I watched those guys go ahead. Well, I watched them in their prime go up against each other in playoff series, and Duncan ate them alive. And so, but again, if you look at the numbers, probably they're pretty much the same.
Yeah, the best way to evaluate Timmy is Tim Duncan is a lot like, and I think Celtics fans, I don't know how they'll react, or at least Boston fans will react to this, but Timmy is a lot like Tom Brady. I mean, honestly, he is very, outside of 2003 and 2002 when he won MVP of the league, when he was just, he was scary. But outside of those years, he really, like you said, has been an average player in the regular season, and then comes the postseason, you know, outside of the last 2 years between 08 and 2012, though, that 5-6 year period, Timmy really wasn't around, which again, it baffles me that he's been so good the last 2 years. Cause I thought he was just going to drop off after, you know, 2010, but he's been a pedestrian overall player in the regular season. No one will remember how he performed in the regular season throughout his career, except for maybe early on in his career. But after like 05, after they beat the Pistons, when he was definitely finals MVP, after that year, Tim Duncan really hasn't done anything in the regular season. For the last 10 years, Tim Duncan's been irrelevant in the regular season. It's been the postseason where he's dominated and where he's done his work. And you can make that argument and make that case for a guy like Tom Brady. I mean, oh yeah, Tom Brady had an MVP year in 2007. We're not going to deny that. Undefeated year, 50 touchdown passes. No one's going to deny the fact that he was MVP that year. But outside of that year, can you really remember games and the great stats of Tom Brady? Will you remember that outside of 2007? No, you won't. It's the same thing with Tim Duncan. And Tim Duncan has been that way pretty much his entire career outside of, you know, 02, 03, you know, in the year before that as well when he won MVP back-to-back years. But outside of that, yeah, he really hasn't been anything in the regular season. But like you said, when you actually watch game film, if you want to see the dominance of Tim Duncan, just go watch Game 6 of the 2003 NBA Finals when he just destroyed the Nets. That's all you got to know. Watch that game. He was two blocks away from a quadruple double in Game 6 of the NBA Finals. That's ridiculous. Like, that doesn't happen anymore. And you know, Shaq, what Shaq did was ridiculous too. But Timmy was, oh my gosh.
Well, I'm a Giants fan, so I want to make an anti-Brady argument, but unfortunately, we're out of time.
Yeah, we are out of time. Okay, well, thank you again for listening to the post-game show. Again, the late night edition is almost 2 a.m. Eastern on the East Coast. It is just hangout time central here on the West Coast. It's almost 11 p.m. We will get off the air. Chamberlain, hopefully we can do this again sometime.
Definitely. Have a good one, man.
All right, you too.
Good night, everyone.
This has been the Celtics postgame show on clnsradio.com. Thanks for listening. The Celtics might not be in action every day, but we are, so stay connected. Follow us on Twitter at CLNS Radio and check out our broadcast schedule for the best weekly sports podcasts on the web.